Gamanu with her. So, our topic for tonight is highlights of the National Unity Government, 1984 to 1988. So last time we did the 84 election, and we did some of the elements that happened afterwards. But tonight I want to discuss in greater detail how did the country function politically, and what were the significant events of a very tumultuous 4 years. So, to start off with, there were three national unity governments in the history of Israel up until this point, including this government. The first was the very first government, the provisional government of David Ben-Gurion after the founding of the state up until after the first Knesset election, included basically a wall-to-wall coalition of all the significant Jewish parties. The only ones who were out were the communists. Even the revisionists had representation on the provisional council, but not in the cabinet proper. Okay, so why did this happen? Why was there the inclusion of all the significant Jewish elements politically? Because, number one, it was a continuation of the style that had existed in the Yishuv period of trying to co-opt as many groups as possible, with the labor faction being the plurality and therefore the dominant element. But also, after statehood, everyone has to buy into the idea that the state has coercive power. And if you only had the plurality labor faction of the Mapai with certain like-minded other satellite parties, but everybody else in the religious camp or the so-called civil camp was out, then maybe they're not going to buy into the coercive power of the state. So you need to have everybody buy in for about a year. And then after the first Knesset election, Ben-Gurion realized that at that point he was able to form a narrow majority government using moderate wings of the religious camp and the civil camp and excluding the communists, the radical leftists, Chayrut, even the general Zionists for a while. Okay, so this was what Ben-Gurion realized. I don't have to have wall-to-wall coalition anymore. Then, when was the second occasion? On June 1st, 1967. You have the inclusion of Rafi, which was Moshe Dayan and Shimon Peres, but most importantly Moshe Dayan, and Chayrut, the Gachal, Menachem Begin, in a National Unity Cabinet. But really, it was not out of necessity. It was out of the perception that at a time of national crisis like the Six-Day War, it would be better to have as many voices included as possible, but not that those voices on the margins of the cabinet really mattered. In other words, Menachem Begin didn't play a role in the Six-Day War. Gachal's representation was minister without portfolio. It was all for window dressing, really, but important window dressing, nonetheless. When did it collapse? 3 years later, when the peace process made this impossibility, that the willingness of the Labor Party to go along with American-inspired peace efforts was too much for Menachem Begin to handle, and so he left, and you're back to just the alignment being in control. 1984 was the first time that it was absolutely necessary to include both major blocs, that without which you could not have a functioning government. Meaning in 67, it was perfectly possible for Levi Eshkol to continue without, you know, the other factions joining in. He just chose a different course of action. But 84, it was impossible. You could not function without both blocks in. So, with that in mind, how did they divide the spoils? How do you figure out who gets what in a divided government? Because ordinarily, you have one major party that's in. They have junior coalition partners who get some little token spoils, but otherwise the big portfolios go to the big boys. Okay, you know, the top 10 candidates and the major party list, they get the various portfolios that are relevant to them. That you can't do this time. You have to split it up. So, it was perfectly clear that as Shamir and Peres in the rotation agreement are going to hold the prime ministership and the foreign affairs portfolio. Why is that the case? Because Shamir had been foreign minister under Begin. It was something that he enjoyed doing, and he wanted the authority to control foreign policy. And Peres, as forever the diplomat, also wanted control over foreign policy. So whoever's not functioning as the prime minister will get the other job. They'll be acting prime minister and foreign affairs. But unlike in America, where a presidential candidate who loses goes back to being whatever they were before, governor of some backwater state, or mayor of some irrelevant city, or an ex-congressman, okay, which means they have nothing. In a parliamentary democracy, if you are a prime ministerial candidate of a major party and you don't win, but your party ends up in government, you have to be given some juicy piece of the pie because you have your own constituency that is backing you into the next cycle. So, the people who ran for office but didn't win, they lost to their party's preferred candidate, they have to get something significant. It can't just be a pittance. Well, on the left side of the aisle, in the alignment, Rabin lost to Peretz. But he has to be given something because people like Rabin. What's his job? Defense minister. Does it make sense? Of course it makes sense. He's the next chief of staff. He knows security, and he knows nothing gunished about domestic affairs. It never interested him. In both his two times as prime minister, he couldn't care less about domestic affairs. He cared about defense and foreign policy. So, make him defense minister, and have him get that job the whole term. No rotation on defense. He's the man. And by the way, that worked over quite well, because the right side of the aisle did not disagree with Rabin's defense posture. In fact, they very much liked it and thought that he was closer to them than he was to labor. There's a lot of truth to that. Now, what about compensating the Likud for losing out on defense? And defense is a big deal. If we're not going to get it, you got to give us something in return. So, the two candidates who, well, one of the two candidates who had run for the prime minister's job will have to be given a juicy economic portfolio. And that is going to be Ariel Sharon. He's going to be given commerce and industry. All right? Commerce and industry. What about finance? So remember, the Likud party is a composite party. It's Chayrut, but it's also the liberals. Now, the liberals really are a bluff. They have no constituency whatsoever. It's a sham. How they were able to get away with this all these years, I don't know. But their leader was Yitzchak Modai and was given the finance ministry until he made fun of Shimon Peres and was fired. All right? Unceremoniously gotten rid of. Now, what about agriculture? So agriculture is important because the agricultural ministry historically has had a very big say over what goes on in the West Bank and Gaza in terms of Jewish settlements. So the Labour Party wanted it because historically the Labour Party has a big association with the kibbutz movement and the farmers' lobby. So they demand the agriculture and they get it. Okay, but what about housing? Okay, housing is the other one that is important in the territories, and that's going to go to David Levy, who was a prime ministerial candidate and is interested in housing because he comes from development towns. He comes from Beit She'an, and in the development towns, you need housing. It's all a wreck. It's urban blight. So he gets housing, labor gets agriculture, which means that the policy in the territories is going to be conflicted. On the one hand, labor has this ministry, on the other hand, Likud has the other ministry. Who's going to win? The answer is nobody wins. There's going to be a trade-off. And what is the trade-off? The trade-off is that there will be no major expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza during this four-year period. There will be some natural growth, but no major settlement drive to put people in out-of-the-way places. But on the other hand, there'll be a tight-fisted approach to security, and that the Arabs will really take it on the chin. So in other words, the security apparatus will clamp down on the residents of the territories to the benefit of those Jews who live there. They shouldn't be in danger, but there won't be Jews in out-of-the-way places. Yeah.
Is this a byproduct of American administration?
I don't think so. This was reflecting the reality of a split Israeli electorate. So you get a little bit, but you have to give a little bit. Okay. Now, what about the religious parties that were included? Notably Shas and the NRP. So they're at each other's throats because they're competing for voters. They're also competing for spoils in government. And the two things that historically had gone to the NRP were which ministries? The interior and the religious affairs. Also social welfare, but they end up not getting that this time. That goes to Moshe Katsav, also representing the development towns. He comes from the Negev, all right, and he's interested. Kamalachi. And so he wants to improve the lot of the people in who are suffering, the underclass. So the Interior Ministry and Religious Affairs historically went to the NRP. They can't have both. Why can't they not have both? Because they've gone down. They only have four seats. They have nothing. Bupkis. So the Shas has to get one of these two. But NRP had the right to choose first. Which are they going to take? Interior or Religious Affairs? And why? They're going to take religious affairs. Interior is important because of issue of who is a Jew and immigration and, you know, that sort of thing. And Shas as a Haredi party will make hay with that. But the NRP cares about the Kesef for its religious institutions and, generally speaking, control over state religion. Remember, the Rav Shachs of the world couldn't care less about state religion. He cares about his religion. And the state be damned.
Say that again.
So Rav Shach and the Degel HaTorah faction, he's of the viewpoint, it doesn't matter what the state of Israel says about a certain halachic issue or what their policy they try to implement. We, the Haredim, will live our lives and do our thing. We have our halacha and our poskim, and state religion is irrelevant. But the NRP, to them, state religion is the be-all and end-all. The Rabbanut HaRashit and all the functionaries. So they want that. Very, very important. Okay. Now, both Shamir and Peres had a personal interest in keeping the coalition alive and honoring the rotation agreement. Number one, from Shamir's standpoint, he goes second. So of course he wants to keep it alive. When you go first, after you're finished, you know, who cares what happens afterwards? But the guy who goes second, he wants to make sure that this deal is not reneged upon. But even Peres was careful to keep this for the four-year term and not to push too much or illegitimately for an early election, because so long as there isn't an early election, he gets to do his 2 years. And then, for the following 2 years, he's the boss of labor. He doesn't have to worry about an internal opposition to him from Rabin or whomever. And he gets to be foreign minister and acting prime minister. There's perks that accrue to him as an individual that he might lose if the whole thing is overturned. Okay, now, as the two sides come together towards a centrist position out of necessity, there are voices that are muzzled, and those are the far left and the far right. Gush Emunim and Peace Now, the polar opposites, were a big deal. Gush Emunim in the mid to late 70s, Peace Now in the late 70s, early 80s. What do you hear from either one of those groups in 1984 to 1988? Basically nothing. They're not so important at this time because the centrist position is the dominant one. And those in the margins have to keep quiet. I mean, Kahana's in the Knesset, so he's doing whatever he's doing. But he's a lone wolf, and nobody really cares about him other than to eliminate him when the time comes. So you don't have radical voices driving the discussion. Okay. Now, Peres, while he was prime minister, did a few important things. Number one, he improved relations with Egypt by resolving the Taba issue. And I want to discuss the Taba issue now. Well, what happened was that Israel pulled out of the Sinai in 1982, in April of 1982. And Israel's position was, what it set forth, its claim, that the 700 yards of beachfront in Taba really belonged to the Ottoman Empire since 1906, and not to British-controlled Egypt, and that the maps that had been used for a few decades had been incorrect and needed to be revised. Actually, there were about 15 points of machlokas between Israel and Egypt concerning where the international border was, because there was no fence, it's just desert, open desert. Later, they built a fence. Today, there is one. But then, it was just open territory. So most of these issues were resolved without much controversy, but Taba was a big controversy because a major hotel was built there and people enjoyed going there, and so on and so forth.
Who built the hotel?
An Israeli. Okay. So what ended up happening was that Israel went to arbitration with Egypt, a five-man arbitration panel, one Israeli, one Egyptian, and three neutral parties. And the arbitration panel ruled in favor of Egypt that whatever maps they had, or it was the disagreement about maps, the bottom line is the international frontier is further to the east and not further to the southwest. And so therefore, what the Egyptians were claiming is the Emes, and Israel has to withdraw from Taba. Okay, so the Likud blamed Peres for going to arbitration, for agreeing to go to arbitration. It was your decision, Shimon, and we lost, so it's your fault. Labor would respond, no, it's not Shimon's fault. Arbitration was part of the 1979 Israel-Egypt peace accord, that any outstanding issues would have to be resolved in that fashion. Better a five-man arbitration panel than a full-fledged war. Okay? There's a certain seichel to that. Well, moreover, labor would argue, that had Israel agreed to compromise on Taba earlier in the controversy, it would have gotten something in return instead of getting zero when the arbitration panel decides 100% in favor of the Egyptians. So it was the intransigence of the right-wing Israelis that cost them everything, so Labor would argue. The Likud would then say that Labor's proposed international conference, which we'll talk about in a minute, would yield the same Taba-like results and bring Israel back to the pre-67 borders. In other words, if we're leaving things in the hands of someone other than ourselves to make a determination, putting aside matters of war-making, but just peaceful determination by means of some arbitration or some other party, they're all going to decide against us and we'll be back to the Auschwitz borders or before the Six-Day War. Is that a fair assessment? Probably. I mean, up until Trump's Golan decision, that's basically correct. So the Likud argument is quite strong. But then again, so was the Labor argument that Begin agreed to this and we should have compromised earlier. Okay. So, as for relations on the Eastern Front with King Hussein, things were good. Why? Because Peres and King Hussein had long-standing cooperative relations, and the goal was to prevent PLO terrorism from crossing the eastern border, and for a few year stretch in the 1980s, that's what happened. Later you have the Intifada, which is an internal matter, but most of the external, the attacks that come from beyond Israel's borders happen in the north from factions that are radical breakoffs of the PLO. But the eastern border itself is pretty good because King Hussein is cooperating. All right. Well, in 1986, King Hussein warms up to Peres's idea of functional compromise without the repatriation of any territory. Now, what am I talking about here? If you remember back to after the Six-Day War, there was a basic disagreement about how to compromise on the territories. One school of thought, the Yigal Alon school of thought, was give land back to an Arab state, notably Jordan, and make a new international border, which is more favorable to Israel than was the old border, considerably more favorable, keep 30% of the West Bank or something along those lines, but the Arabs keep the Arabs. Whereas Dayan and Peres had believed, no, Israel keeps everything, but where the Arabs live in the West Bank and Gaza will be given robust autonomy in confederation with the Jordanian state so that no foreign soldiers ever cross the Jordan River, but much of the West Bank and Gaza is foreign to us because we don't go there. That it's almost like the PA after the Oslo, except instead of the PLO being in charge, it would be the Jordanians in charge in a civil administration. All right, so the Jordanians had never really agreed to this. They wanted 100% of their territories back. And
even
that's,
though they would have gotten the Arabs.
Well, the King Hussein, the Hashemite dynasty, didn't mind taking on an additional Palestinian population so long as they were going to get territory with it, at least up until 1988. They would later change their tune. Now they don't agree to that anymore. Yeah. Okay, but so up until this point, King Hussein had not shown any interest in this, but now he's beginning to show some interest. The question is, can you find in the West Bank and Gaza prominent local Arabs who are philo-Hashemite and anti-PLO? And the answer is, you can find a few of them, but they typically end up dead. So it might be a stillborn idea, but it's an idea. It's the ha'optzia ha'yardenit, as Shimon Peres would refer to it. The Jordanian option.
Hebron, what was his name again?
Huh?
The guy who was the head of Hebron.
Levinger.
What?
Moshe Levinger?
The Arab.
Oh, the Arab? I don't know.
And the name is interesting. But he was the major factor over there against the PLO.
Right, correct.
He was making Shabbos for himself.
Correct. There were a few people like that in major cities.
Nablus also had.
Correct. So, what happened with this? Well, in 1986, in October, Shamir takes over as prime minister. Peres is no longer prime minister. And since that's the case, Shamir is not interested in any functional compromise. He's interested in no compromise. He's a hardliner. But Peres does not give up on his idea just because he doesn't hold the top job. So he's going to conduct a rogue foreign policy as foreign minister, knowing that it doesn't have the approval of half the government, including the top of the government, but he'll do whatever he can. And on April 11th, 1987, he famously concludes the London Agreement with King Hussein. The London Agreement was an agreement to go to an international conference at which the Palestinians will be represented by a Jordanian delegation and not the PLO, and that at this international conference you'd have participation of the world powers, but would then lead to direct bilateral negotiations between the principal parties. And the only reason to have the conference was to, as a cover, as a fig leaf, to give Hussein the wiggle room in the Arab world that he's not making a separate peace with Israel and not being bossed around, but rather has the support of those world powers that were seen as favorable to the Arab side of the equation, like the Soviet Union, or for that matter, the Chinese. So the Likud doesn't agree to this at all. They think, if we go to international conference, we're going to have to give away the store. And the Shimon can't be trusted to do this sort of thing. We have to crush it. When Shimon comes home after the London Agreement is signed, Shamir wants to see it. And Peres won't give him a copy of it. So there's game playing. He wouldn't allow the Prime Minister to see a physical piece of paper that had the signed agreement between the Foreign Minister of Israel and the King of the Hashemite Kingdom. No. Everyone knew that this could only happen if the head authority figures agree to it. But what happens next? So the agreement called for both parties to engage Secretary of State George Shultz and try to get American cooperation and American leadership in moving the process along, because the Jordanians recognized without American involvement, Israel would feel as though they were being cornered, because the other world powers were anti-Israel. So you need the American involvement, and also, America had the muscle to make things happen. So Shamir, wanting this to go nowhere, sends Moshe Ahrens, minister without portfolio, mind you, not a high-ranking minister, but a high-important figure in the Likud, to America to talk to Shultz and say, this doesn't have official Israeli approval, cut it out, let's drop it. Why Ahrens of all people? Well, number one, because the foreign minister is Peres himself, who is the one who is the renegade. And you need someone who speaks a good English. Ahrens spoke as good an English as anybody else, as anybody in this room. So he was the good choice to send to crush rogue Israeli foreign policy. And it worked. Nothing happened. Well, we'll see that the Optzia Hayordanit will die a year later because of other things that take place late in 1987. But let's discuss a few more things now. Yeah. They hate the PLO, but as for the Palestinian population in the West Bank, those were Jordanian citizens. They were, even into the late 1980s, they were Jordanian passport holders, and it was the desire of the Jordanian state to once again rule over them and have East Jerusalem and be a big, large kingdom. So Black September of September 1970 was a very, very dangerous time for King Hussein. He almost died because Arafat's henchmen took over significant parts of the capital and the airport and almost took over the country. It was the Jordanian forces together with the Israeli Air Force that saved Hussein from the combined efforts of the Syrian military invading from the north and the PLO running around all over the place.
There's the Soviet Union in the background was also playing.
Yes, because Jordan had historically been pro-West and not pro-East. All right. Now, as for Israel's relationship with the Eastern Bloc, what happened in the mid-80s? Under Peres, there was a concerted effort to improve relations with the Eastern Bloc, and in fact, diplomatic ties were reestablished with Poland. Not that that's so important, but they were. What about the Soviet Union itself? So there was a liaison office opened in Moscow, but As for real diplomatic ties, that would have to wait until 1991 for two reasons. Number one, there were still limits on Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union to go to Israel. And secondly, the Soviet Union was supportive of the PLO. So glasnost would improve the immigration situation, but even under Gorbachev, the relations were not close and they were not formal. Okay. What about relations with the United States in the mid-1980s under both Peres and then Shamir? Well, there were certain hiccups in the relationship. Number one, there was the Lavi Project. So the Lavi Project, which was initiated in 1982, was supposed to be Israel's indigenous own, you know, self-made fighter pilot, a fighter jet that would replace its reliance upon American-made materiel and maybe even be exported to other countries and cut into American defense exports. So the Americans were not too happy with this idea. The reason why it was ultimately scrapped in 1987, a decision that Moshe Aaron said was a grave mistake by the state of Israel, but the finance ministry and even the boys at the top realized we have to scrap this project, was number one, American opposition, but number two, and even more importantly, it cost too much money. The cost overruns were tremendous, and Israel is suffering from economic crisis throughout the mid-1980s. So you can't spend money on everything and anything if this is taking too long and cannot be finished within budget, then it has to be abandoned.
Well, no, relying on a U.S. engine.
Correct. So there was money for the U.S. to make, and there were those companies that were sad to see this project scrapped. But the American government and ultimately most of the Israeli government realized this has to not continue. That was one bit of difficulty. The other was Pollard. But Pollard, interestingly, did not become an issue for the two sides of the political aisle in Israel to try to one-up the other. Yes, he was arrested while Peres was prime minister, but Shamir didn't make a big deal about it for political gain because it would have just damaged the national interest. Sometimes a scandal is a national scandal and we have to cover it up or minimize the impact of it and not use it for partisan advantage. And Pollard was an example of that. The other was Iran-Contra, that again could have been used for partisan advantage but was not. Basically, Israel tried to bury the issue and not rouse the ire of people in the American administration or the American Congress. Okay, so as for Pollard, Abba Eban's committee on Defense and Foreign Affairs in the Knesset concluded that Peres, Rabin, Shamir, and Ahrens all bore responsibility, and especially Peres. Why? Because they were the prime ministers and defense ministers at the time. But, again, despite Eban's committee saying, you know, someone should pay a price for this, basically no one did. And, in fact, Pollard's handler later went on to become, the direct handler was persona non grata in the United States ad hayom hazeh, but the higher-level handler became a government minister. Okay.
Who was that?
What's his name? Eitan. Rafi Eitan. Not Rafu Eitan, the chief of staff. Rafi Eitan. He just died last week. Yeah. Okay. So, another scandal that needs to be addressed, and again, an area where political gain could have been attempted but was not, was the Bus 300 affair. Oh, the Bus 300 affair was a real crisis for the Israeli government. But not a partisan crisis. It was a crisis of the rule of law versus the entrenched establishment. So what happened in the Bus 300 affair? Bus is going from Tel Aviv to Ashkelon, and it's hijacked by four terrorists who were, in hindsight, regarded not so much as skilled terrorists but as clownish kids with a grenade and some guns, but who really were not up to the challenge, and that's why they lost. All right. So the bus is driving south. It drops off a pregnant woman in the middle of nowhere, just north of Gaza. She hitches a ride, calls the police, and says the bus was hijacked. The bus is traveling at 70 miles an hour, going towards the Egyptian border. Eventually, it stopped about 10 miles north of the border in Gaza. And the Shin Bet, the military, the police, everybody shows up on the scene, And leading political officials show up on the scene because this is a protracted thing. It doesn't all go down at once. The bus, the tires are shot out, so it can't move, but there are people trapped. Okay? So it extends until the next morning, 7 a.m., 13 hours. Finally, the army makes its move, and one passenger dies. The other 25 are rescued. Two out of the four hijackers are killed. And the other two...
Died.
Okay. So what happened? Officially, they died. What happened? Newspapers, Chadashot, which was a paper back then, ran a picture of the Shin Bet hauling away one of the two surviving hijackers. And there was all sorts of claims that this didn't happen, this is a doctored photo, you weren't there, blah, blah, blah. A lot of lies. The bottom line, what really happened was, two guys lived, and then two guys were butchered. They were bludgeoned to death with sticks and stones. Who did it? The Shin Bet. The head of the Shin Bet authorized it, and the guy who actually carried it out was Ehud Yatom, who later became a Knesset member, and was nominated by Ariel Sharon to be his national security advisor. And the Knesset, or the Supreme Court, negated the appointment on the grounds that he's not appropriate because he killed somebody with his bare hands who wasn't supposed to be killed. So this was covered up for a while, but eventually you couldn't cover it up any further. Okay, so there were charges brought against 11 people, including General Yitzhak Mordechai, who later would go on to have a political career. And Mordechai was acquitted. Other people were not yet charged, but could have been charged for perjury and for submitting false information to the police and so on and so forth. Top people in the Shin Bet and other parts of the... Huh? Obstruction of justice, yes. So,
what happened to the two guys?
They were dead. They died. They were hit to death. They were smacked to death. The first two died on the bus. They were shot to death in a firefight. The other two were bludgeoned to death. Okay, so ultimately, Chaim Herzog, the president of the State of Israel, issues a pardon, an all-encompassing pardon, to everyone who was involved in this affair. The Attorney General of Israel was furious about this because he wanted charges to be pressed. And there were efforts to undermine the pardon. And there was an attempt in the Supreme Court to overturn the pardons. That was an unsuccessful challenge. Ultimately, the pardon stood. Everybody was off the hook. So why was the government suppressing information and then pardoning people, not firing the Attorney General for his attempts to pursue this issue? The government collectively, a national unity government of two polar opposite parties, they agree, let's bury the whole thing. The answer is because all the major figures had spent their life in the security establishment. Who were the principal parties here? Yitzhak Shamir, who was prime minister when it happened, Shimon Peres, who buried it when he was prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who was the defense minister, and Chaim Herzog, the president of the state. Well, what was the life story of these guys? So Chaim Herzog was the head of military intelligence, was the founder of Amman, of the Israeli military intelligence. Shamir was the leader of the Lehi and an employee of the Mossad, spy. Rabin was the chief of staff and a lifelong soldier. And Peres was director general of the defense ministry, deputy defense minister. Defense minister's whole life was in the security of the state. So they all owed their allegiance to the security establishment and did not want to see the dirtiest of laundry being aired in public without the military censor crossing things out about an episode which was damaging to state interests. So therefore, bury the whole thing. It's not that there were outside actors, you know, from foreign countries criticizing Israel for its mishandling of two Palestinian 18-year-olds. No, it's that Israel as a liberal democracy has a certain element of the population that isn't going to like the bludgeoning to death of teenagers, even terrorist teenagers, and is not going to like government cover-ups and the firing of government employees who are trying to overturn a cover-up. I mean, it's a scandal. It's a classic scandal. The Israeli Supreme Court back then was less of an activist court, but was turned to on a regular basis to adjudicate controversial state issues. Also, Israeli Supreme Court justices would then be appointed after the fact, well after the fact, to lead national commissions of inquiry to figure out what the truth was and to find best practices going forward. I mean, most of the big commissions we've spoken about all this whole season were led by some Supreme Court justice, and this is no exception. The Landau Commission by Supreme Court Justice Landau was established in 1987 to figure out what the Shin Bet can and cannot do so that you don't have these kinds of cover-ups going forward. All right.
Why weren't the people in charge prevent the two kids from getting killed?
They wanted them killed.
Why? Just to
They were angry. In the moment, they were very angry. Okay. So, on the issue of money, running out of time, so on money, I mentioned last time that the National Unity Government was useful in that it resolved the economic crisis, that Israel had been in an economic downturn basically since the mid-70s, up through the mid-80s, with the early 80s being especially disastrous and hyperinflation and employment issues. So July 1st, 1985 was Yom Kippur. Let me say that again. July 1st, 1985 was Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur Kalkali. What does that mean? What is Yom Kippur? You fast. What is Yom Kippur Kalkali? Cuts to the bone. Okay, we're going to trim the fat. Everything that can be cut from the budget must go. And who's going to do this? So Yitzhak Modi was the finance minister, and he did a reasonable job with government cooperation, but he got into a fight with Peres and he had to be eliminated. So he was made justice minister, and the justice minister, Moshe Nissim, was made the finance minister, in part so that no one could take credit for having made the economy turn around, that each one could only claim partial credit, and then thus no one would be a challenger for the prime ministership. It was all very calculated by the guys at the top to make sure nobody could get credit at the bottom. But Moshe Nissim, who was the son of a chief rabbi, Nissim, he was very popular. A Sephardic Jew, traditional Jew, a lawyer, a shrewd lawyer, and somehow he went against the grain. Although normally, finance ministers who institute budget cuts for domestic spending are reviled by the public, and before an election season, they reverse course and give away goodies because they don't want to be reviled by the public, and they want to steal as many votes as through bribes. And that's what Yoram Aridor did 7 years earlier. Nissim said, no. The public understands that we overspent and that the economy was in crisis because we overspent. They will recognize the rectitude of a trimmed-down budget. And so, on all matters, even defense, certainly in the settlements, every aspect, even social welfare, will trim it. And you know what? The public actually appreciated it because the economy did turn around. Inflation was dropped to next to nothing. And when I say next to nothing, I mean 20%, which in America would be a disaster, but by Israeli standards was a mechaya. Okay? And the employment situation, although normally when you do a lot of budget cuts, unemployment goes up because government employees are fired and so on. It didn't happen because there was enough of a private sector turnaround that the economy as a whole didn't shrink. The problematic features were resolved and new problematic features didn't emerge. So that's why Nissim was well regarded in Israeli history as probably the best finance minister they ever had. Okay. From Modi. Nissim and Modi switch places. Okay. What about the First Intifada? So the First Intifada broke out on December 9th, 1987, and Israel was unprepared. It started as a fatal traffic accident in Gaza, and when I say accident, I mean accident, not intentional, but on the ground in Gaza, there were all sorts of propaganda saying this was willful, the Jews are killing the Arabs on purpose. It was an accident. These things happen. Okay, but it was turned into a big deal.
What was the nature of the accident?
A traffic accident.
Gaza?
The 4 hours got killed. It was at a corner. There was a collision in the corner. Intersection. Okay. So, correct, in 1991. So, from how is Israel going to solve this problem of the Intifada? They were not ready for war against a large population of civilians. Israel was accustomed to fighting either nation states or terrorist groups, but not rock-throwing or thousands of rock-throwing civilians. So Rabin took a tough stance on the violence, and he was actually out of the country when the Intifada started. He was in America, I believe, and he had to come home, cut his trip short. So he, from the outset, he says, the territories can only be resolved through a political solution. But I'm not here to put that political solution into place. I'm the defense minister. What is my job? My job is to keep the violence to a minimum, and make sure that over time it fizzles out. And why will it fizzle out? Because Israel is the stronger party. And so, yes, this might last for some length of time, but eventually the Arabs and the territories will realize they're gaining nothing from their bad behavior, and they'll stop behaving badly. Plus, they will not want to have their bones broken. So, it took a long time. It took a lot longer than anyone anticipated. So, the hard left and the hard right attacked Rabin for this. As you could understand, the hard right, the Kahanists, would say, kill them all, you know, or drive them out of the country. And the hard left would say, how can you do this to innocent civilians? A rock thrower is not a guy with an M16. How can you shoot someone, even with rubber bullets? So you have, you know, the real pacifist types who say this is too much, and the real rightists who say this is insufficient. But both Peres and Shamir thought that Rabin was handling it very well, that it was a tough line, but an appropriate line. Okay. So the Likud and Labor, although they were divided on many issues, they were able to sustain the government because they could come to some kind of a consensus, whether it's on the war in Lebanon or the economy. We'll resolve our differences, we'll settle our differences and solve problems. But when it came to the Intifada, there was no agreement about the political and diplomatic ramifications. On the security front, they let Rabin break their bones. But as for the diplomatic and foreign policy implications, polar opposites. The Likud accused Labor of being at fault and causing the Intifada because the London Agreement and the Optzia Hayardenit and all the Shimon Peres talk about giving away territory made the Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza think that Israeli rule was coming to a near end, and let's makarves hakeitz, as we would say in rabbinic literature, let's hasten the Messiah by having an Intifada, and it'll kick the Israelis out even sooner. So that's the Likud argument against Labor. It's your fault. You got their hopes up, and now they're all riled up. Labor would accuse Likud of the exact opposite. You, Likud, are at fault, because you give the Arabs no chance of any future, and it's been 20 years since the Six-Day War. These people have had a generation of living under our boot, and they're tired of it. And you know what? They're going to rebel. And you can't blame them for rebelling. So we'll suppress it, but we understand what their plight is. That's the machlokas of Likud and Labor. Which one is a more compelling argument? I'm not going to take a vote. Okay. So, in 1988, you have a major event. There was a complete non-event, but it was a major event simultaneously. And that is, on July 31st, 1988, King Hussein permanently closed off the Jordanian option, Optzia Hayordanit. What did he do? He renounced the Hashemite kingdom's claim over the West Bank and said that the people who live in the West Bank are no longer Jordanian citizens. Their passports are no longer valid, and they are now Palestinians, and their political representation is the PLO. How do you like that? So why did he do this?
He didn't like it.
Well, the answer is that he realized there never would be a Jordanian option approved by Israel that would give him the territory in its totality, or maybe even any of the territory in a real formal sense of full military and security control. That Shamir is in power, Peres is not, The trajectory of Israeli politics is to the right. He's gaining nothing from this charade of still claiming control over a people that he doesn't control anymore. So, entrench himself on the East Bank, throw the West Bank to the dogs, and that's it.
Well, he also saw the Palestinians as fighting the Israelis on the ground.
Right.
He didn't want this population.
No. Right. So the boisterousness of the Intifada proved to Hussein that this population would not be a docile population if he ever got his hands on them. So let him not get his hands on them. Yeah. All right. Well,
he has enough Palestinians.
As it is. Yes, as it is. So the Likud saw this as proof that the Jordanian option never really existed, that it was an illusion in the mind of Shimon Peres. And you know what? Maybe they're right. That it never really existed. It was all a big bluff. Labor, however... Okay, Labor, however, saw this as an unfortunate byproduct of Likud's intransigence, meaning the Jordanian option would have been a real possibility to solve the Middle East conflict if it weren't for the fact that the Israeli public put Likud in power, and Likud is hardline right, and they don't want to have any concessions, and so there were no concessions, and so the Jordanians just walked away. So, which side is right? Was the Jordanian option an illusion, and Likud is right that Labor was off its rocker, or was Labor right that Likud got in the way of what could have been a good solution to a problem? All right. Well, Tichia, the hard right, which was not in the government, and are the voices that have not been heard from for the 4 years, they said they were, you know, peace now, and Gush Emunim were quiet for a while. Now they get up and say, well, if the sovereign country of Jordan is renouncing its right over the West Bank, and we, Israel, are the only country that was produced out of the British Mandate, and the territories were a disputed territory because two nation states were in machlokas over it, well, what should we do now? Annex the West Bank! Meaning, who's in our way? The PLO? The PLO is a terrorist organization. They don't matter. And as for the population, so we'll absorb them somehow. Somehow. Okay? But that's Tichiyah's line. Let's take advantage of the diplomatic breakdown and annex the territories. All right? Well, what does the hard left say? Once we're going to indulge the political extremes in some opinion, what does the hard left say? They said, you know what we have to do now? Negotiate with the PLO. That up until now, that had been like taboo, verboten. You don't even say it. Oosh, you know, you can't talk about the PLO. So now the Meretzes of the world, well, Meretz doesn't exist yet, but Mapam and the dovish wing of labor, and the communists for that matter, would all say, Jordan is out, we have to have a peace process, negotiate with the PLO. Okay.
Even though they're terrorists.
Even though? Oh, okay, so are they still terrorists? Now, what does the PLO do? The PLO realizes they have an opportunity here. The American administration, Reagan, in his second term, was pressuring Arafat to issue some kind of a declaration in which he renounced violence and accepted Resolution 242 as the basis for the resolution to the Middle East conflict. And in late 1988, shortly before Reagan's administration comes and goes, Arafat makes a big announcement in which he declares a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, effectively renouncing Palestinian claims over Israel proper, and recognizes 242. And the American government thought that as an implicit recognition of Israel's right to exist within the old borders, and so the PLO was no longer considered a terrorist group, and America had now had ties with the PLO. All this happened in the waning days of Reagan's administration, much to the chagrin of the Israelis. Huh? It doesn't matter whether they believe him or not. The point is, the American State Department and the White House wanted him to say it, and as long as he said it, that was good enough. Words matter, supposedly. Okay. So, what happened here was that in the late summer of 1988, the combination of King Hussein's announcement, the ongoing intifada, and the soon-to-be Israeli election for the 12th Knesset in November of 88, all these three things are coming to a head, so that now Israeli civil society was more divided than ever over the issue of the territories. If I think back into my childhood of there's an Israeli right and an Israeli left, like today you don't have right and left. Yeah, today you just have Netanyahu. But back when I was a kid, you know, there was the right and there was the left, and they were at loggerheads, and you know, they didn't like each other. So the moment when this was most crystal clear was in late 1988. That's really when you have the complete division and fury over each side's policy. Okay, so one of the things that could have happened, just to change the topic a little bit, one of the things that could have happened while there was a national unity government was a change in the election law, raising of the threshold for entrance to the Knesset, which stood at 1.1%, which is nothing. And that didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? I mean, after all, if the two major parties had always had a problem of these splinter parties getting, you know, getting in their way and siphoning off seats, you would think that when the two big parties together control the whole country, they'd pass a rule saying you have to have 2%, 3%, 4%, some bigger number. I don't have a good answer for that. I wish I did, but this is one of these odd questions. It benefited neither of the major parties. And eventually the threshold would be raised. Now it's 3.25% such that you can get only 4 seats or more. You can't get 3 seats or less. But for whatever reason, nothing came to pass. Okay. In the few minutes we have left, I just want to mention a few other things that happened in this time period. Not everything was about angry politics. So, one was the rise of a certain political personality to fame. Not so much fame in Israel, but actually fame here in New York. And who am I referring to? Netanyahu himself, correct. Benjamin Netanyahu was appointed as Israel's ambassador to the United Nations and served the full 4-year term from 84 to 88 throughout this whole national unity government. Who put him there? Well, he was put into the position by Shamir in the waning days of the outgoing administration before the 84 election, and he held the office. He was the protege of Moshe Ahrens, but eventually they'd have a falling out and would run against each other for the Likud leadership in the late 90s, with Ahrens doing respectably well, but not winning and Bibi maintaining control. A personality clash, really, more than policy, I think. But Ahrens was more consistently hawkish than Netanyahu was, especially when Netanyahu made the Hebron Agreement in 1997 and then the Y River Accords in 1998. Ahrens was opposed to that. Okay. Some good things happened. Natan Sharansky was released from the Soviet Union on February 11, 1986. Ida Noodle came in 1987. Some refuseniks, you know, showed up on the scene during this period of time. Why did that happen? Was it because of glasnost and perestroika? Was it because of political calculations by Israel and the Soviet Union? You could argue either way. Another major good event was Operation Moses, January 4th, 1985. 7,000 Ethiopian Jews come to Israel. So this was controversial only insofar as their Jewish status was questioned by some, but that was resolved by the Sephardic chief rabbi, and the Jewish agency and other international Jewish groups bribed all sorts of African officials, and the State of Israel was able to bring home a lot of Ethiopian Jews. On a sad note, Ron Arad was shot down on October 16th, 1986, and never to be returned. When it comes to the issue of returning prisoners, the most controversial of the decisions of this period was the 1,150-3 lopsided exchange that happened on May 21st, 1985, the so-called Jibril Agreement, because it was between Israel and Ahmed Jibril's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Why did Israel do it? They wanted to bring home their soldiers from the Lebanon War. The deal was criticized by the general public, despite being agreed upon by the cabinet 24-1. Only one member of the cabinet voted against it. I forget who it was, but it was a lopsided vote in favor of this lopsided deal.
Who was the prime minister?
Peres was prime minister. But Shamir went along with it. Shamir and all the Likud ministers went along with it. It was criticized by the public because not everyone on the Israeli side was included in the deal. The ones who were lost in the Sultan Yaqub battle, for whom this shul and many others davened in the Mishaberach for the Nedarei Tzahal for many, many decades, were not returned. Now, whether they were alive or dead, Israel never knew for sure. Presumably they were dead, and by now it is long assumed that they died. But at the time, that was not definitively known. And so 3 out of 6 or 7 or 8 people were returned home, but not everyone. And if you're not getting everyone, why give 1,100 prisoners to the other team, including some very bad actors? Most famously, Kozo Okamoto, okay, the Japanese terrorist who committed the Lod massacre at the airport in 72, and Ahmed Yassin, the founder of Hamas, the blind sheikh in the wheelchair, okay, who eventually got his comeuppance in 2004. But this was a very lopsided deal, including people with blood on their hands, the blood on their hands business. So much of the public didn't like it, but the government felt it needed to do this. One last point for tonight. The night of the gliders was in November 25th, 87, was again an attempt by a rejectionist front of the PLO to cause damage in northern Israel. They came in on gliders, two of them. One of them got caught. One of them killed 6 soldiers on an army base. So terrorism is ongoing, and the bad guys are trying to kill as many as they can. The Intifada was a popular uprising, but having been a popular uprising that was not instigated by the bad boys in Tunisia, in Tunis, okay, who were in charge of the PLO, they would very quickly take control of it. And so that the Intifada went from the Amcha in the territories to being just a horrific operation run by real arch terrorists, some of whom had to be assassinated. And Israel would send the periodic mission to bump off Abu this and Abu that throughout the 1980s, including into the first Intifada. So we'll stop here.